If it please the court, we have a handout of the statutes and rules to give you. I was looking forward to going last and having a little easier time, but we'll do the best we can first. The relief Abbott requests in this proceeding is to sever and transfer one case, the claim of Maria Lopez, to St. Louis County. Judge Stith made clear in Norfolk and Bayer that there can be no such thing as piggybacking jurisdiction. It's time now for the court to address the next question, piggybacking venue. In terms of the reasoning of the concurring opinion in Abbott, once a case is designated for separate trial without a St. Louis plaintiff, there is no longer a pig to piggyback for venue. In terms of the majority opinion that is still open to consider Rule 51.01, there's no theory to support piggybacking at all. That's because Rule 51.01 expressly states that these rules, including Joinder 5205, shall not be construed to extend the venue of civil actions. We think under either rationale, under the rationale of 5101 or the concurring opinion rationale in Abbott, this case needs to be transferred, separated, severed, transferred. In more scholarly terms, there are two rationales that support Abbott's request for relief. Rule 5101 precludes the use of joinder to extend venue. Focusing on Rule 8413, the majority opinion in the Smith case did not reach 5101. The concurring opinion assumed 5101 did not preclude joinder at the beginning of a trial. Using convenience and efficiency.
You mean at the beginning? You mean at the filing of a case as opposed to the beginning of trial? What if they had all been tried? Instead of severing them, they decided to try all the cases together?
Okay. If they decide to try all the cases together, I think it's what you have to decide on 5101. Judge Wilson's concurring opinion, in some ways I feel awkward telling you what you wrote. I'm sure you have a better idea of what you wrote or intended to.
One never knows.
Yeah, there you go. Talked about, look, there are reasons that courts for judicial efficiency might want to do things. And when you look at venue, it's clear that the most sensitive time at venue is when you have a trial in front of a jury. And is that jury really connected to your claim? So that if you look at it earlier, say, discovery of common issues, you might have a different way to look at whether joinder would be appropriate at that stage. I would suggest if you read 5101, it precludes that. It simply says you can't use these rules to extend venue.
But you recognize there may be two separate questions, whether that's referring to venue for trial or even if you can't extend venue, you might join things for discovery for efficiency.
Yeah, I don't think the rule reads that way, but I think you could look at it that way. I think the common sense would, you know, there's a reason to say that's different. But certainly when you get to trial, it's different. And it's a concept of connectedness that you talked about in terms of jurisdiction that Bristol-Myers talked about. The court that has the power to hear the case has to be connected to it. There's no doubt that across the state of Missouri, there are different values and different sensitivities of our citizens. We recognize that in representative democracy by having different election districts. Nobody would think that people in Nevada or Tarkio would want St. Louis voters electing their representatives.
Could the legislature write such a venue statute, though? So the venue for tort cases anywhere in the state?
It said connect. Well, I think that's an oversimplification. I think they said for tort cases.
No, I'm saying could they?
Oh, could they? They could. That is within their power to determine connectedness. I agree with that. I'm sorry.
We've already looked at the actual venue statutes, and when there are more than one plaintiff like these, it's not at all clear that they thought venue was improper.
Well, I think it is clear if you look at all the statutes or if you look at the statutes in connections with the rule. I know you talked about the quandary between 508, 0104, and 5 and what happens when you have multiples. Well, I would suggest that what happens when you have multiples is clearly set out in two places. The first place is your Rule 5101. You can't use one person's venue to piggyback another, to extend venue to another, simply because they're joined. Another way you could look at that is you look at Section 1.030, the section that talks about in our statutes, when we use the term singular, we also incorporate the plural. Now, that's written Missouri law. And in this case, then, if you go to 508.010.4 and 5, they talk about not any plaintiff. I'm going to go to 4. Venue shall be in the county where the plaintiff was first injured. It doesn't say where any plaintiff was first injured. That's the way it's being interpreted now.
Well, let me ask you about
that.
Yes,
go ahead.
I know it's not this case, but it seems like to me you're almost promoting a venue by count as opposed to venue by case.
No.
What if there's an accident on the county line?
Yeah.
It's a mass accident, but this plaintiff's injury has occurred in Nottoway, and this plaintiff's injury has occurred in Atchison. Do you really think we'd have to have separate venues for those personal injury cases?
Judge, I'm glad that's not our case.
I know. The words.
I would say, you know, we're a court of laws and rules, and we follow the laws and rules. We can't make it up. We can't change it because we don't like it. And here it talks about the plaintiff. It doesn't talk about any.
Yeah, but it talks about any count. And you can't read any counts.
Well, it says in any count, then this clicks in.
Right.
But it doesn't mean it's venue by count. It's venue by the lawsuit. I agree with that. But then I'd like to go on, and I still want to come back to Rule 1.030. When you have multiple plaintiffs, who's first injured? I think the plaintiff that's first injured. That's at David Ockenberg's article. And it's absolutely clear. There really doesn't need to be a quandary between 4 and 5 if you all would simply read the Rule 5101 or read the statute 1.030. It's designated. Now, I would also point out, Judge Robertson said, you don't need to consider that the legislature clearly enacted the statute to limit venue, because you don't look at that until it's ambiguous. Well, I think you've already said there's a quandary. So that was established in Abbott, that this is some of these statutes are hard to read. And I still want to go back to that connectedness idea and talk to you, because you wouldn't think that some of our outstate people would be happy to have their senators' representatives elected by a St. Louis City electorate. Why should they be happy to have their cases heard from a jury in St. Louis instead of those of their peers? And that's exactly what venue has been all about. It was said very nicely in a Florida Law Review article in 2014, Markowitz and Nash, Constitutional Venue. From its inception, the concept of venue was intended to protect parties from litigation in locations where they face an unfair advantage. That's the very core of venue, connectedness. That same idea, connectedness, that's in jurisdiction that we've already recognized through Bristol-Myers on Norfolk Bayer. The same concept is with venue. We want a jury that's connected with your claim, not just any jury, certainly not only the jury that's recognized to be the probably the most generous and highest. And Judge Pell, I'm not going to make you say that St. Louis judges and juries aren't fair. I understand the reluctance there, but you don't have to. Judge Robertson already commented on that in DePaul versus Mummer. Judge Wolf recognized that in Lithium versus Calvin. We've already said in Missouri law that St. Louis juries are the most generous, and it's at a disadvantage for a party that's a defendant to try a case there. That's why we have all of this going on. You know, lawyers from over 9,000 plaintiffs all across the country don't bring their plaintiffs so far from home to try their cases for no reason at all. But there's no rule of law in the nation, not constitutionally, not statutorily, not anyway, that says St. Louis, Missouri is the national clearinghouse for mass torts. And there's certainly no law in Missouri, constitutionally, by statute, by court rule, that says St. Louis is the national clearinghouse for all torts, mass torts in Missouri. Judge Wilson, you were thinking creatively when you wrote your concurrence, looking at, by common law, fashioning something of an MDL proceeding. If the court's desire is to get its arms around these cases in an MDL-type proceeding similar to the federal, so be it. But if you're going to do that, you ought to do it by rule and you ought to do it carefully. Not everything starts and ends in St. Louis, the most favorable venue for plaintiffs. It ought to be looked at, it ought to be handled fairly for all parties. And it ought to, as the federal MDL proceeding, there all cases are transferred back to their original venues, to connectedness,
and
for their trials.
1 minute left, so I want to make sure,
yes,
you're,
sure,
you're getting to this on the severance versus separate trial,
mm-hmm,
which you kind of just gotten to with your last,
yes,
comment.
Yes.
Why was it an abuse of discretion not to sever here and instead to order a separate trial?
Well, when he orders a separate trial, okay, the whole theory, this is the theory of the two, this is the new two-step. The old was the Meyer Court two-step. This is the new Garvey two-step. The two-step here is, to get you to venue in St. Louis City, I have to connect you to somebody who has venue. And we say we're doing that under 5205 for efficiency and convenience. But then to be able to get a separate judgment that I can independently collect on, I have to separate that out, sever it, and then send it up according to 7401. And what value is a judgment to a plaintiff if they can never collect on it, if they have to wait until, in our case, 24 other cases are tried till they can collect it? So that's the two-step. One, oh, for efficiency and convenience, we're going to join them. Oh, but now it's time to have a separate trial that I can get a final judgment out of. Second step. So when they take that plaintiff out of the group that's anchored by the St. Louis plaintiffs, there's no anchor here anymore. There's no tie to venue. There's no connectedness. It has to be severed and transferred someplace else.
What do you say to the respondent's argument that you might, even though you intend down the road to try multiple plaintiffs' claims concurrently, you might pick a bellwether case so that everybody can acquaint themselves with the issues and the logistics of the trial and where exactly you are going to have common issues and questions?
Yeah, what's interesting, there's the bellwether idea has never been discussed in this case, never on the record. Read it till your eyes fall out. That's not what they're talking about here.
Well, it does seem,
and secondly, on the bellwether, for a bellwether to be effective, defendant has to look at it as being a case that indicates how it would turn out in all the other cases. Not many corporate defendants will look at a St. Louis venued result and think that's the way it's going to come out anyplace else. It has no value as a bellwether because of the way St. Louis handles its cases. I would also like to point out that there's one thing that's very important here. The Missouri St. Louis City plaintiffs are the anchors to hold venue. Once you remove them from the case, there's no more an anchor, and these cases have to be distributed back to where they belong. This is all happening at the sacrifice of the St. Louis City plaintiffs, who have to wait till the end of the line to get their cases tried because they're the anchors.
Well, thank you.
Whoops, I'm sorry.
Yeah. The bellwether question is on the table.
Yes.
Wasn't Lopez selected by
The practice that they've...
Two cases where it has to be selected.
Yeah, the practice...
One by the plaintiff and one by the defense.
Yes, Your Honor.
Wasn't Lopez selected by the defense?
Yes, the practice in all these cases, just so you're clear, the judges have brought the plaintiffs in. Plaintiffs have never volunteered to this, but they said, we're going to try them. We're going to try them one at a time, most of them, all of them in that have gone to verdict on Johnson & Johnson and then these, and the judge says, you pick yours and you pick yours. One of the problems is that plaintiffs also tend to dismiss out defendants' picks, although this one hasn't been dismissed out.
May it please the court. This is prohibition. And I hope that's not lost on the court, because prohibition is an extraordinary writ that should be granted only in the clearest of circumstances. Now this, as Judge Price indicated, is a sort of a new thing. We're here parsing a concurring opinion. It's not a rule involved. It's merely a concurring opinion. And I believe that if we parse it, we find that this is a failure of pleading case. Because the concurring opinion, assuming for a moment that all seven of you agree with it, requires there to be...
That's a pretty big assumption.
Yeah, which I think
we
could safely say.
I think we had two votes last time, right?
Well, I just...
We're very persuasive, I assume you think.
But assume it...
Let's start with the one that got a majority of the court. How do we keep that, which spawned this, from being just, in effect, a right of interlocutory appeal that the legislature never granted?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Judge Wilson.
Well, how do we keep the preference expressed for the writ procedure in the majority opinion? How do we keep that from becoming just a right of interlocutory appeal that's not found in any statute?
Well, I'm not sure it's the court's responsibility to do that. I think the court's responsibility is to look at the rules as written and the statutes and apply them, not to add words, not to make things up, and I'm not suggesting that anybody did here. But I think what we have here is a circumstance in which 24 cases were filed, one has been tried. To Judge Draper's point, Lopez, the case that's the underlying case here, is a defendant's pick. I assume that means they think it's the case in which they have the greatest opportunity to be successful. And while no one has said the word bellwether, I see in your opinion an affirmative duty for there to have been an announcement, that word is used twice, or a determination, that word is used twice, that each case is going to be tried separately.
And I know you said, you thought the opinion says that every case has to be tried separately and that has to be announced or else there's no reason to change venue. But if you're incorrect on that, why is venue proper here once there's been separate trials, appeals? Why isn't that really severance, except that you've avoided that label to avoid a transfer of venue?
Well, the court knows, or at least I assume Judge Wilson and the two of you that joined him know what the word each means.
I'm asking a different question. Take that aside for the moment. If we weren't to agree with your argument that it meant every case has to be ordered up front for separate trials, so we're not dealing with that situation. We're dealing with the situation where we just said you're trying this case and you're trying it separately, so therefore it separately has to be venued. Tell me why that's wrong, or tell me why that doesn't require then severance as opposed to separate trial.
Well, respectfully, Judge Stith, what I think that ends up doing is destroying the efficiencies that might exist under Rule 5205, which was, as opinion you joined said, the motivating force behind Rule 5205.
And how are those efficiencies destroyed when the trials are separate and the appeals are separate anyway?
And I would say because there are certain things that can happen here. For instance, there's been a trial in which this court has affirmed these facts. Abbott lied in its black box, and its black box defense is not valid.
Well, assuming we did that, why would it matter if that was a separate case? If you're talking collateral estoppel versus law of the case, why would that matter?
That's not been argued, but I think a motion to apply that would be sustained.
But why would it matter if it's the same case? I'm not getting why the efficiency of a separate trial is opposed to
Because the second trial then might be a trial in which we don't have to address those. And if you, and but I think
wouldn't that be the case for severance too? Is what I'm asking you.
Well, Your Honor, I don't. We haven't brief that, and I don't want to just wander off into the woods here. But my guess is that the plaintiffs would suggest that that's the case. The defendants would say, no, it's not. This is a separate trial, or collateral estoppel doesn't apply anyway.
Well, and that'll be, of course, a separate issue. But,
sure.
But I'm trying to figure out, if you have separate trials and separate appeals, how is that different than severance, other than in name, is the key argument,
well,
thing I want you to address.
You know, Your Honor, I guess what I would suggest is that there's an ecosystem that's created by the rules. One surrounds 5205, and one surrounds every other case. And what we have here is, I believe, and I say this as respectfully as I know how, a confusion between what the word severance means and what separate trials means. And frankly, if separate trials and severance were the same thing, then we wouldn't need to use different words. But severance, according to the federal rules, and I know we don't follow them except when they're persuasive, but Charles Allen Wright and everyone else suggests that severance creates an independent, distinct case, and both parties are removed from the petition, and it's as though a new trial happens. Separate trials are designed to create these efficiencies, as the concurring opinion says. They are designed to allow the court to learn, the parties to see what works and what doesn't.
Well, in the second case, Judge Bertelsen makes a real solid effort to explain why one individual trial on the front end might create the context for having multiple trials or joint trials later on. Did the judge in Lopez make that effort? Or is it a fair inference that the judge in Lopez intended to try all of these individually?
Well, and that's why I said at the beginning, Judge Wilson, this is a pleading failure. The motion to sever never said that each case had been set for a trial. The trial court was never asked to decide that question. Had it been asked, it could have reached either conclusion. I'm going to try them all one after another until we get them all finished. Or I believe that we can try some multiple ones later. But how is the trial court to be convicted of an abuse of discretion when the trial court is never given the opportunity to express his opinion on that issue?
Well, wait. If the court didn't express their opinion in this case, what was it doing asking each party to select the case? What was that all about?
Well, Judge, I agree with you that is, even though nobody said there's a bellwether, and nobody has literally said we're going to try all these cases together, although, Judge, and it's not, I can't point to it into the record, but I'm going to help you off the record, that there's at least one multiple plaintiff case that Judge Omer's considering. They're related. They're two children born from different times to one particular mother.
Just twins?
I don't believe they're twins. They're separate in different ages and whatnot. But I guess we just don't know. And if the standard is...
Well, we do know there's, 13 states or a bunch of different states, a bunch of different injuries. They're not all going to be tried together. But your argument would be they may be tried in
subgroups. They may be tried in groups.
Why would that affect whether this case was severed for a separate trial? Why would that affect whether this is really severance or whether it should be severance?
Well, back to that point, the ecosystem is designed to let the trial court at some point see whether or not there is efficiencies. And that happens in every case in which there are a lot of these going on. The trials begin. There is Rule 7401 allows there to be an appeal.
Well, that's a separate question. Does it, if you're saying if the same issues are going to be retried and retried and retried, why is it appropriate to appeal it?
Well, because you reach, as happened in this case, or at least I would argue, a resolution of key issues that are going to apply to the rest of them. But that's not all of them. And ultimately, it goes back to this. Why would the rules talk about separate trials and severance as though they are different? And Your Honors, these are your rules. You get to say what they mean. And I must tell you that I'm certainly not going to stand here and tell you what I think they mean, except on behalf of the client here. And I believe there are two ecosystems that have been set up. One, as Judge Wilson suggests in the concurring opinion, that allows the trial court broad discretion in deciding whether and when to sever properly joined claims. And its decisions in that regard should be affirmed as long as they are rationally related to the goals of efficiency and expeditiousness. Now, Judge Omer was never given the chance to say whether or not what he was doing was headed in that direction or not, because the motion never pled it. The motion simply said, here's the concurring opinion. We file a motion to sever. You've got to sustain it, and there's no discretion. And his ruling is a handwritten one-liner.
What, and it came, and the last severance motion came before Abbott was decided.
I believe there was a subsequent one filed after Abbott was decided.
Well, that's where I get lost. When was the last motion to sever heard and decided?
It was decided right before this court issued its writ. So it was after, because it quotes your concurring opinion.
It quotes extensively from Barron.
Well, yes.
I mean,
in
was
the court's
it,
order.
Was it were there different grounds stated, or was it different law quoted?
Say again, I'm sorry.
Were there different grounds for the severance that we're discussing here today than the prior motions which were heard and denied?
Venue. They re-brought up the venue question, which Judge Price spent most of his time.
Well, they quoted extensively from Barron and from the statement in Barron that once you separate it for separate trial, once that decision's been made, the trial court has discretion to deny severance only in the rarest of circumstances. They
That's
quoted
correct.
That part and said that should be applied here. In
That's
their motion.
Right. That's exactly what they said. But they never said, and one of the difficulties in this case is what's the rule? And we're assuming that the rule, for purposes of this argument, is the three-judge concurrence.
But procedurally, the motion to sever was filed after the decision was made to try Lopez individually. Is that correct?
The decision to try Lopez individually was made in 2014.
But the motion to sever was filed after that?
Yes.
And the request was to sever all the individuals or just Lopez?
Just Lopez. And ultimately, that's what was filed in this case. Because there's not a trial schedule that says 1 through 23 of the remaining cases. There is an order that mentions one other case, that, which would be perhaps tried separately. But all of that stuff was stopped when Barron came out and this court issued its writ.
But so, if I understand your position, you're saying if the court had ordered separate trials up front, said all these cases are going to be tried separately, then it might be an abuse of discretion not to, or at least it would be a different question whether it was an abuse of discretion not to order severance instead of separate trial, but that you can't say whether, you can't call it an abuse of discretion if you just ask for this one to be separate. Is that your argument?
My argument is, there must be a determination that each case, now, I'm just going off the concurring opinion. I don't know what the rule is. But if that becomes the rule, the first element is each case, not any case, but each case has been set for trial independently.
And why?
Why?
Because would that be the rule?
By setting, to use the concurring opinion's logic, by setting each case independently, the efficiencies that might attach to the remaining cases are gone. But until that happens, you don't know what the trial court has up its sleeve in order to make these things go quicker and more efficiently. And until the trial court is faced with an opportunity, or let's just say a demand that it say what it intends to do, which is absent here because they never pled it.
I'm having trouble seeing if the court tries them seriatim and holds the cases in the trial court until they're all tried, there's no efficiencies to a separate trial.
And
presumably that's why they're certified under 7401 for separate appeal, but doesn't that make it a severance case if they're tried separately and appealed separately? That is when you sever normally. It's just not given that name, so it doesn't affect venue, it sounds like.
Well, Judge, the words are chosen for a reason under the law.
I understand, and I'm saying, isn't this word the wrong word to describe what, in fact, the court did? If he ordered it tried separately and appealed separately, why isn't that severance?
Because severance creates distinct cases. And
Why wasn't it an abuse of discretion not to grant severance when this has all the attributes of severance? It just has the name separate trial.
Well, what I would say to you is that even under the concurring opinion, which I recall that you joined, there has to be some depth of efficiency and expedition that takes place before this makes sense.
Right.
And the trial court, had it been asked to, may have just said, yes, we're going to try 1 through 23, and if I'm 90 when it's over, somebody else will have to be here. But it hasn't been given the obligation to express itself.
Is it your position that venue in absent a party being added or deleted, that venue is established or not when the case is filed?
I believe, Your Honor, that that's the rule. You know, this is not a Tuesday. I'm out of time, but I've sure got a lot
please,
more to say.
Please answer my question. You'll have a couple other cases where you might be able to sneak in your other opinions.
Your Honor, I think, as you said in one of the cases that we quote, this was designed to stop pretensive joinder or pretensive non-joinder. None of that's happened here. The word or is in there, not and. And if you sever, you take both of them out. Now, if I don't think 508.012 applies in this case, even if you get to that point. And I respectfully suggest that if it said and, I would agree with you. But or is different. This is a venue problem. We have to look at, as the concurring opinion did, you look at joinder first, then you determine whether venue is proper under joinder. And I've got a long speech on that, but I don't have time to give it yet. And then there is an opportunity to keep the case there. If the court wants to change its rule, which it might, then it ought to. But how does the trial court get convicted of an abuse of discretion when the opinion is read and the rules are read, and under every previous interpretation, severance and separate trials are different? And how does the trial court know the answer to what to do, particularly when the pleading doesn't give it the opportunity to even express itself? Thank you. I appreciate the extra time. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take the water.
You can. You can tell you've made Chip and I both dry.
Counsel, why don't you start off with that point? What is it about the motion that put to the court the question of whether it was anticipating trying these cases one at a time, seriatim, or trying one or two and then seeing whether we could bundle up some of the rest?
Really, it was your concurrence, because in your concurrence, I think, I'm sorry I don't have it with me, but in the next to the last paragraph, you say once they've been designated as separate trials, then it's an abuse of discretion not to sever it. You already answered that question.
No. I'm saying, was the question put to the trial court whether there were still efficiencies to be gained in these cases by trying one or two by themselves at the front end?
I don't believe that was ever discussed in those words, but I think you can't be unmindful of what's going on in reality when we talk about separate trials and severance. One, what has been happening is that they were all designated for separate trials. That's how they move along. Then they severance when they get them. The idea of having separate trials in these huge mass tort cases and just leaving them then stacked up, unappealable, never giving the defendant a chance to remove the cloud from those verdicts, never allowing the individual plaintiff the chance to get their money in their lifetime while we try all the successive plaintiffs' claims. Because that's the only way you can keep the anchor of venue, is just not procedural sense. It won't work. Trying these cases together won't work. In the sense of Abbott, we're talking about a prescription drug where you have women in states all across the country with different medical conditions at different time periods. The time span for the Abbott plaintiffs is 20 years. The scientific knowledge is 20 years of scientific knowledge continually changing. There are different warnings and all these different labels that different prescribers use. There are different injuries to the children that were born from headaches to spina bifida. Trying that together has been termed a nightmare of jury confusion. This whole scheme doesn't work in the practical, real world of litigation. It is only a scheme to obtain venue, and we shouldn't be letting the tail wag the dog on getting justice.
But isn't there some value in combining? Maybe they shouldn't have been joined. Maybe they should have been consolidated. But isn't there some value even for your client that some of the discovery be done together instead of in 13 different cases in 13 different states, we actually do one expert deposition instead of 13.
You know, none of that's in the record. There's nothing in the record about all these efficiencies that's argued. It's not stated. I want to talk to you about, so that's one way to look at it, that there are some common issues. And there are common issues that could have common discovery. In a number of ways, you could get that. But when it comes to trying the cases, those are all lost. And you have to look at the cost. This isn't a no harm, no foul situation. Right now, there are 22,000 civil court cases pending in St. Louis City, 5,000 in the county. In St. Louis City, there were only 45 jury trials. So it'll take 7 continuous years just for these cases to get tried. All the while, the plaintiffs from St. Louis are waiting as anchors. This is a morass of a nightmare that really does have an effect on all the other St. Louis litigants waiting to get their cases tried, and especially on the St. Louis plaintiffs that can't have their case tried without coming to the separate trial severance issue of yours. But I think you really answered the severance one. And to Judge Smith on each, you don't know whether each case is going to be tried separately. Does there have to be one order saying that, or is it just each order all along? You don't know till the end of the game how that happens. And I would suggest the best way to look at it is the way Judge Wilson did in his concurrence when he says, when you separate out one plaintiff, that's when you look at that, is that the case that's being tried separately? Thank you.
Thank you.